Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is July 1st, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Hello, everyone.
And Angela Meaden.
What was that?
That was how you always do it.
Good evening to all our listeners. Thank you for joining us once again. We are recording this on Friday night. Just to show you how dedicated we are giving up a whole Friday of awesome parties and cocktail drinks and wild sex just so we could record Consilience.
Because that's what we normally do on Friday nights.
Yeah, that's the way we roll.
It's not like we sit on the couch and watch Star Trek or anything like that. All right, let's start with teaching Angela to appreciate history.
Right, so on July 5th, which is the day before this podcast should go out, but we make no promises, in 1687, the great Sir Isaac Newton published his magnum opus, the Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, or the Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, which obviously is one of the most influential scientific publications in history. The publication actually has a fairly interesting history. Newton, as many of you may know, was a bit of a, how do I put this? Bit of an asshole. And he had all these brilliant ideas, and he was indisputably one of the greatest minds who have ever lived, but he had all sorts of varied interests, and when he just started working on the Principia Mathematica, he was actually far more concerned with things like alchemy and so on. January 1684, Edmund Halley, who is famous for, of course, Halley's Comet.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, it's the same one, and he was working, or around that time, he started working for the Royal Society, which was a newly formed organization at that time, and the premier scientific body in the world. And he went to go visit Newton, and he talked to Newton about a debate he had had with Christopher Wren, the great architect, but Wren was also a scientist in his own right, and with Robert Hooke, who's of course famous for mostly his biological works. But Hooke claims to have derived the inverse square law before Newton, and there was actually later on quite a dispute between Newton and Hooke. And the most famous dispute, of course, with Newton is between Newton and Leibniz over the invention of the calculus, because they did correspond about calculus, but you know, Newton didn't publish, and then Leibniz published. But anyway, this is just one of many of these feuds that Newton had with people. That's just the kind of guy he was. He was extremely unpleasant.
Like you said, he was an asshole.
Yeah, he really was, unfortunately. And when Halley visited Newton, as I said, he described this debate he had with Wren and Hooke, and this served as the impetus for Newton starting work on this fantastic and vastly influential book of his. And we've spoken a bit before about how very often there's no single identifiable inventor of an idea that can be singled out as the sole originator of any idea. And interestingly, the same goes for the inverse square law, which is just that the strength of gravitation decreases by the square of the distance between two objects. Newton, although he made extremely important contributions, was not the first person to think up this idea of the inverse square law. He was also certainly not the only person to see the significance of Kepler's laws that were derived empirically, and which Newton then took and worked into his laws of motion. It's just another example of there being a right time, as it were, for an idea. Even someone as recognizably brilliant and amazingly intelligent as Newton didn't come up with the ideas out of whole cloth. He was influenced by other people. And as we've said many times before, it's the mark of a scientist. And as Angela mentioned with Einstein last week, it's being embedded in a larger scientific endeavor, which was really what the Royal Society was meant to foster that allows scientific progress to occur.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I heard a story about Newton when he was investigating optics, that he was sticking things into his eye like sharp needles.
Yeah, that is Newton.
He wasn't puncturing his eyeball. He would push the back end of the needle behind and beside his eyeball to see how, if he deformed the shape of his eyeball, it would affect the image that he would see. So that was the optics angle there.
Mm.
So he wasn't literally stabbing himself in the eye, although he could easily have done himself some damage if he had slipped.
And the other honorable mention for teaching Angela to appreciate history is not July 5th, but July 1st in 1858, is the joint publication of papers by Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace on evolution. And this is yet another example of even the greatest scientists of all time, like Darwin or Newton, not being the sole originators of ideas. That Darwin had worked on his great breakthrough, which wasn't evolution. His great contribution to science was natural selection. Natural selection is the explanation for why evolution occurs. Darwin is by far not the first person to suggest evolution happened. That goes back to the Greeks. And he's also, incidentally, not the first person to suggest natural selection. That goes back quite a while as well. In fact, his grandfather mentioned, sort of in a poetic way, that kind of thing. But what Darwin did is he set out natural selection and evolution in a very empirical and detailed way, as did Alfred Russel Wallace, who had sent Darwin a letter of his work, an idea that he had while, I believe he was in Malaysia at the time, and he was suffering a bout of malaria when he came to his breakthrough. And interestingly, both men, both Darwin and Wallace, were inspired by Thomas Malthus. And Malthus, as you may remember, is the very depressing, very pessimistic person who said that because population increases geometrically and food resources can only possibly increase arithmetically, you're going to always have cycles of starvation and famine followed by plenty, and then the population increases and then you get starvation again.
The boom and bust model.
Yeah, it's the boom and bust model essentially. And both Darwin and Wallace were inspired by exactly this idea. This is the idea that stimulated them to think, well, what if we apply this to, say, frogs, and what are the consequences of that? Well, it won't be random that which frogs survive. The frog that happens to jump a bit further or digest food a bit better or have a little bit better vision will be more likely to survive under conditions of scarcity, which will always occur given Malthus's assumptions. Therefore, you get natural selection. And Malthus, in turn, was inspired to write his book in response to the Marquis de Condorcet, who was a brilliant and absolutely amazing French Enlightenment figure who was killed during the French Revolution by the Jacobins. But if you've not heard of Condorcet, he's truly a remarkable man, and I suggest you have a bit of a look. His writings are absolutely amazing, and he was Voltaire gets a lot of credit, but I think Condorcet stands head and shoulders above someone like Voltaire.
So in other words, evolution by natural selection and the inverse square law and the calculus, these are ideas that their time had come, and somebody was bound to stumble across them, and it just happened to be those guys. I mean, obviously you needed to have a brilliant person looking in the right place at the right time, but it was going to happen inevitably. It was just, those were the guys who happened to stumble over it.
It's less that it was inevitably going to happen, that sort of harks of fate. I think what it is that we take incremental steps in our understanding of the universe, and as we have these great minds, we can connect the dots a little bit better so the picture becomes clearer.
Mm-hmm. Right, so these predecessors had done the underlying groundwork that needed to be done in order for these guys, Newton and Darwin and Wallace and so on, for them to take the next step and come up with these groundbreaking theories.
Mm. But it's just a fascinating counterpoint to the idea that quacks and charlatans sometimes seem to have, that, you know, when they're trying to square the circle or prove Einstein wrong or, you know, whatever their pet theory is, that you could just sit alone in your garage all by yourself with no scientific training, no knowledge, no connections within in the scientific community, and you can come up with something by yourself on your lonesome that's going to completely revolutionize science. That, as far as I know, has never happened.
Well, you'll come up with something, but it's not likely to revolutionize science.
It's unlikely to be true.
Yeah, it's more likely to betray deep misunderstanding of science.
Sure, exactly.
We say sitting in our lounge.
It might still make you a lot of money, though.
Potentially.
Just look at power balance. There's no science in that.
Indeed. Sure.
But there are infinite number of propositions, and only a tiny, tiny proportion of those are true. So the probability of any given proposition being true is absolutely infinitesimal. So unless you have some evidence that your proposition is true, it is deeply irrational to believe it is true. And the problem with a charlatan is the only reason they have to believe their propositions are true are just egotistical, because they want them to be true.
Mm.
And these people ought to learn some humility, says Michael the arrogant.
All right, then. We don't have any corrections this week because we are right all the time.
I think it's because we're recording so soon after we released the last episode.
Nonsense.
Poor people are just tired of correcting us and we're not taking their corrections.
No, that's not you either. I didn't buy that.
We're looking at you, Ben.
All right, then. Let's move on with the news. Our first story is about astronomers finding the brightest object in the early universe. What's that about?
Researchers at Imperial College London have recently had a paper published in the journal Nature in which they describe their discovery of the brightest object in the early universe. This object was a quasar, which is a quasi-stellar object. We don't really know what they are, but they seem to be involved with black holes and crazy things like that.
I thought we did know. Aren't they feeding black holes? Not always?
That's the leading idea, but that's
not been
confirmed. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's an object that looks like a star because it's a single point source of light, but it's too far away to just be a star. So it suggests that it probably is what they call an active galactic nucleus, a feeding supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy that is outshining the rest of the galaxy. But, yeah, it's hard to know that for sure.
So, this one has been called another one of those great sexy astronomy names, ULAS J1120 plus 0641.
Well, plus one to that.
Just rolls off the tongue, that
it
one.
It really, really does. I'm going to call it ULAS from now on.
Nice.
Okay. ULAS is emitting 60 trillion times as much light as our sun.
Wow. Holy crap.
All right. So
that is pretty impressive.
That is one incredibly bright object.
So basically, if we were as close to it as we are to the sun, if you go outside, you'd need sunglasses.
Yes, you'd probably also need a lead cocoon several kilometers thick.
Yeah, you'd need a brush and a pan to pick up your ashes.
ULAS is also extremely far away and therefore extremely, extremely old. Astronomers have measured its redshift, which is a measure of how much the light has been stretched out over time in its traveling to our eyes. And they estimate that the quasar existed something along the lines of 770 million years after the Big Bang.
So that's about 13 billion years
ago. It's approximately 13 billion years ago. So
pretty old.
It's extremely bright. It's extremely, it's massive. And it's very, very old, which poses a few very interesting questions. The researchers think that ULAS is powered by a black hole with about 2 billion times the mass of the sun. So it's massive. Now, how did something that massive form so soon after the Big Bang? And that is the biggest question that has been raised by this discovery. The truth is, we don't know. We have a few possible explanations, which I'm going to give you now. I must admit, I'm not particularly convinced by any of them, but here they are. The first possible explanation is that if the existence in the early universe of seed black holes having up to 1,000 times our sun's mass. So that doesn't really solve the problem because you still haven't explained how we might have 1,000 solar mass black holes in the early universe.
Where did those black holes come from?
Yeah, it's just sort of saying, well, maybe they were littler ones. They may well have been, but where did they come from and how did they get so big so fast?
Mm.
The second possible explanation is a high rate of black hole mergers.
So the universe was a lot smaller back then, so...
So they would have been closer together.
Closer together. So
they may well have eaten each other up a bit more quickly. And the third possible explanation is the growth of black holes without a lot of the light that is given off by infalling material, which would then hide the growth process so we somehow wouldn't be able to see it. I find this to be the least satisfying of the possible answers.
I'm not understanding that.
So when you've got a black hole and material is falling into it, that material itself gets heated up so much that it emits the light. So that's the light that we see coming from a black hole. It's not from the black hole itself. So what they're suggesting here is that somehow black holes in the early universe formed without that infalling matter giving off light. That just doesn't really make sense. I'm not sure how that would work.
That does seem odd.
Maybe they're suggesting that there was some kind of different physical situation at that time in the universe where the laws of heat or thermodynamics or something worked differently, which is wholly unsatisfying. I don't buy that at all.
Right.
It's not entirely implausible. There is a possibility that ULAS is going to help us figure out some questions about the reionization era, which occurred about 150 million to 800 million years after the Big Bang, which is right about at the same kind of time as we think that this quasar formed.
So that's about the time where the first stars and galaxies were starting to kind of form together.
Yes. Okay. So what reionization refers to is a time when all the neutral hydrogen that was basically the universe was starting to ionize into protons and electrons. So we're going from a neutral soup to something that had charge.
For technical clarity, there was helium in the early universe as well because of Big Bang nucleosynthesis.
Yeah, there was some.
Yeah, so there was some. So it wasn't only hydrogen, but Angela's right. It was like 90-odd% or whatever the true figure is. Very high hydrogen.
Yeah, mostly hydrogen.
And hydrogen is the simplest element, and that's primarily what got created in the Big Bang. And of course, the other elements are essentially cooked in stars or in supernovas.
Correct. So light, which the astronomers have analyzed, which is coming from ULAS, suggests that the universe still held a lot of neutral hydrogen at around 770 million years after the Big Bang. So, you know, and this gives us a pretty good idea of the rate of the ionization. So, yeah, this is a very interesting find. Daniel Morlock is an astrophysicist at Imperial College London, and he says that they are going to start examining this particular object in more detail and start looking for similar objects so that hopefully we can understand better what was going on in the early universe.
All right, in other news...
You may have noticed by now that there is a slight theme to tonight's episode.
Yes, we're still in space, but a lot closer to home. This week, we were almost all killed by a giant killer asteroid.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Did someone go up in a spaceship and drill into it and blow it up with a nuke and then split it in two and just in time it missed Earth?
No.
Okay, did someone go up in a spaceship and it was actually mostly made of ice and they blew themselves up into this thing and it crashed, but then we were saved anyway?
No.
Okay, so it's not a 1990s movie.
No, it's not. It also was not a giant killer asteroid. It was just a regular asteroid.
Oh.
It hadn't killed any giants recently.
Yes, no, indeed.
Oh, God.
Yes. So the asteroid in question also has a sexy astronomy name, 2011 MD.
Woohoo!
And 2011 MD is what they call an Apollo asteroid. Apollo asteroids are a group of what they call near-Earth asteroids. See, these are asteroids that orbit the Sun in close to the Earth's orbit and happen to cross the Earth's orbit in various places. So 2011 MD crossed Earth's orbit this week, and that's what happened. And it crossed Earth's orbit very, very close to us. It's hard to say exactly how big 2011 MD was or is, but it's somewhere between 10 and 45 meters long. And we say long because it's much too small to be spherical. So it has a distinct shape. We're not quite sure what that shape is. We don't have any good photographs of it. But it had on its longest side, it would have been as big as 45 meters.
Not small.
It's not small, but for comparison, the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs was about 10 kilometers in diameter.
Right, exactly. Several orders of magnitude bigger.
Yeah.
So this asteroid, had it hit, it would not have caused an extinction event the scale of the dinosaurs.
No, quite right. So 2011 MD passed close to Earth on the 27th of June, just a couple of days ago. And by close, we mean 12,000 kilometers away.
Right? Jeez. That is pretty freaking close.
It's pretty close. I mean, that's about roughly the diameter of the Earth.
Yeah.
And it's well within the moon's orbit, but it's still plenty far away from the Earth's atmosphere. And so that's also within the orbit of the geostationary satellites, which orbit at about 36,000 kilometers up.
So it's well within the orbit of the geostationary
indeed.
Asteroid.
Indeed. So it was pretty close.
Geostationary asteroid.
Well, a geostationary asteroid would be very, very useful because we could use it to anchor our space elevator.
One of the interesting things about 2011 MD is that it was only discovered 5 days before this approach.
That's pretty hairy.
Yeah, 5 days before, and we saw this giant rock coming straight at us.
Isn't that pretty good? Usually we find them after they've already passed.
Yeah,
so
that does happen a lot of the time.
Oh, what was that?
There's a rock that passed us last week. Yeah.
I heard a little bit of stuff about people saying, oh, this was Apophis, and this was Planet X, and it was going to kill us all. And
yeah, the crazy people like to say things like
the
that.
The crazy people really do like to... crazy people. The people with alternative hypotheses.
The stupid people, you mean? Now, the thing is, even though it was 45 meters long, which is pretty big, I mean, that's a couple of buses popped into it.
It's like a rugby field.
Yes, a rugby field, or maybe a football field.
Half a rugby field.
Yeah, that's still pretty big. But even though it's that big, it probably, if it had struck us, probably wouldn't have done any damage at all. It would most likely have disintegrated in the atmosphere, and it might even have caused a really cool explosion fireball that we could have seen.
Depending on its composition, of course.
So yes, yeah.
Of impact.
Right, exactly.
So if it came in very steeply and was made of iron.
Yeah, well, they're saying that the worst case scenario, we'll link to that.
Okay.
We'll link to my source article here. But so the author of that article reckons that the worst case scenario is that there would have been some small meteoritic debris that would have fallen over the South Atlantic Ocean. So, that's fine.
Okay, we can handle what you've got, solar system. Bring on a bigger one.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem. Because 2011 MD is not alone. And there are plenty of other Apollo-class asteroids out there, some of which are a lot bigger than 2011 MD. Mm. Now, astronomers are fairly confident that they've catalogued all the really big asteroids out there, all the Earth-crossing ones, although there's no real way to be completely certain about that. They feel good about that. But these are the really big ones, the extinction-level event ones that would wipe out all life on Earth. They're pretty confident that they know where all of those are. But there are some that are kind of in between the two that are big enough that if they were to hit in a populated area, could literally kill millions of people.
Mm.
And nobody's looking for those.
Well, NASA are now looking for them. They've just been instructed by Congress a couple of years ago to look for the smaller asteroids. But it has a distressingly long time before they have to complete it.
Yeah, and also the resources they have at their disposal are measly.
Mm.
I mean, they just don't have enough telescopes, and they don't have enough time, and they don't have enough equipment to really survey the sky the way they should be doing it.
And if they were to find something, they don't really have anything they could do about it either.
Right. Exactly.
Unless we have a long lead time.
Yes, that's kind of the key. The more time we have between spotting these things and then hitting us, the more options we have about what to do with it. And blowing it up with a nuke just isn't an option.
It's probably the last thing you should do, because then you just have
lots and lots of small ones
that are radioactive.
Yeah.
It's just not a good idea.
It's pretty much an exercise in futility to try and nuke an incoming asteroid. It's not going to do anything of any value.
The best thing would be to try and knock it slightly out of its path so that it would miss us.
Right, exactly. So there are several plans about doing that, one of them which is a gravity tractor. So you park a nice heavy little spacecraft next to it, and then the gravity from that nudges it just enough so that it changes its its trajectory so that it misses us. Or there are also more dramatic ways of strapping giant rocket engines onto the thing.
I'm all for that.
Which is pretty cool.
Using lasers.
Yes, yeah, lasers to heat up the one side so that the radiation pushes it out of the way. These are all very fun and exciting, but they all require time. Especially for the larger the rock is, the longer it would take to move it out of the way. So we really need to have that lead time, and we need to be looking at the sky.
I must say that I'm not all that worried about the asteroids. What really worries me is something like a comet coming in.
Because
when they come into the inner solar system, they are traveling fast. I mean, near Earth asteroids go fast, but they don't go that fast.
Right.
Comets that are incoming really come in very hot. Of course, the faster they come, because force equals mass times acceleration, a relatively small comet moving really fast can do a truly immense amount of damage.
Force equals mass times acceleration, I think that's one of Newton's most simple laws of motion.
Sure.
Thanks, Newton. One nice thing about comets, though, is that they're easier to spot.
Unless they come from the sun side, right? So if they come from, you know...
With the sun behind them, we wouldn't see them.
Yeah, with the sun behind them, we can see them.
You might not think that a comet would pack much of a punch. I mean, it's just what they describe as a dirty snowball. But if you remember the Tunguska event in 1908, I think it was.
Which actually was very close to now. I think that we've just gone past the 103rd anniversary just this week.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
That was an event that happened in Siberia where there was a massive explosion, and the best theory we have at the moment is that it was a comet that exploded above the ground, and there was widespread devastation. Unfortunately, it was in a very sparsely populated area, so as far as we know, there were no real deaths or injuries from it. But if that had happened over Tokyo or New York City or Johannesburg, it would have been a really big problem.
Or Beijing.
Exactly.
Actually, there's a guy who thinks it was an alien spacecraft because he's picked up rocks with funny holes in them or something in the general area.
I saw that episode of Smallville.
Yeah. No, it wasn't Smallville. It was bullshit, I think. Something like that. It certainly is bullshit.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Well, it flattened, what was it, 1,000 miles of forest.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I mean, imagine that kind of thing happening over a densely populated area of China or India.
Yeah.
You're talking about tens of millions, maybe as much as 100 million people dead.
Yeah.
So, clearly, this is a very low probability. I mean, we shouldn't obviously... The universe is a big place. If you've seen these animations with these near-Earth asteroids going around, it looks like there are a lot of them in a very small space. But that's an animation. Right? To scale, they are so far apart that if you're on one, you're not going to see the other, even with a great telescope. They're so far apart. And the universe is big, and these asteroids are small, and so is Earth. So it's a very rare event, especially the bigger ones, and especially comets.
Well, it's very comparable to a human lifespan.
Sure.
Statistically speaking, it's a certainty. It will happen, and it does happen, you know, all the time over geological time.
Sure. Geological time. So within the next 10 million years, we will be struck repeatedly, yes. But it's not something you need to stay up about at night worrying.
No. There's an excellent book on the subject by Phil Plait, who we hope to interview someday, and that is Death from the Skies, in which he looks at all the different ways that the universe is trying to kill us. All right, so let's come a little bit closer to home and talk about chimps hunting with spears.
So this is quite an old story, but it's one that I've wanted to speak about for a couple of weeks because it's just so intrinsically interesting, and I think very few people have actually heard about it. So the story here is that Jill Proyers, who's a primatologist, has done a lot of research with a troop of fairly newly habituated chimpanzees in Fongoli in Senegal. Now, Senegal is a country in West Africa, an ex-French colony, and these previously unstudied chimps have exhibited a tremendously interestingly wide variety of new behaviors. The most surprising of which is what Owen just mentioned, is that the hunting with spears. So before primatologists went to study chimps properly in the wild, a habituated troop, and it takes months, make the chimps used to you so you can follow them around and observe them up close and personal. Before that happened, with Jane Goodall leading the way, it was assumed that chimpanzees were vegetarian, when it actually turns out they're omnivores. They are very well known to eat colobus monkeys, for example. The males will cooperatively hunt these monkeys, and trap them in trees and cut off all escape routes and then kill them and devour them. Usually the females and juveniles do not participate in this, so it was assumed that they just didn't hunt. But what Preyers and her colleagues have discovered, and we're talking, I think this was first reported in 2007 or so in a current biology article, was that they observed juveniles and females making spears. Okay, so that phrase, making a spear, might be somewhat controversial, so describe it in more functional terms. They took a stick, took off the side branches, and then sort of chewed on one end to make it sharp, and then went to tree hollows where bush babies sleep, and bush babies are nocturnal,
and they're the cutest animals you have ever seen.
Piss on their hands so that they stick to the trees.
Yes, but they are also the cutest things you've ever seen. We'll put a photo in the link.
Yeah.
Well, bush babies are very cute.
They are very cute.
I must agree. And they're nocturnal, and during the day they sleep in these tree hollows. And what these chimpanzees were observed doing was taking these spears they've made and then jabbing them repeatedly into these hollows where these bush babies are presumed to be hanging out for the day, and then extracting a bush baby and eating one.
Wow.
So the significance of this is just amazing. When I first heard this, I was, you know, my gasp was flabbergasted, and I was just I was just amazed. You know, it brings to mind the whole Planet of the Apes idea. Yes. Of, you know, the chimps taking over, and
well, there's that new Planet of the Apes prequel coming out soon.
Oh,
that's scary.
Oh, right.
It's all about how they become intelligent and they start taking over the world. That's exactly the images that was running through my head while you were describing the story. That's pretty scary.
Or the Eddie Izzard skit where he talks about the chimp with a gun and you teach it to reload.
Give me a banana.
And we did a whole hand thing. Anyway, watch Eddie Izzard if you haven't. He's a brilliant comedian. And there is a bit of an update. The team observing the Fongoli chimps have a blog, and it's savannahchimp.blogspot.com. And in 2010, in July, so about a year ago, almost exactly, they revealed that they've now documented at least 100 tool-assisted hunting episodes. Wow. Or found the actual spear, or observed it, or so on. And in that year, they recorded 40 tool-assisted hunts by Fongoli chimps.
Wow.
So it doesn't appear to be an isolated event.
Hmm.
It appears to be
the norm.
Yeah, it appears to be the norm. And it's mostly females and juveniles, although some males also participate, engage in this activity. These chimps are pretty cool. It's also been known for quite a long time that chimps fish for termites. So they take a grass stem and, you know, poke it down a termite nest, and the termites chomp down on the piece of grass, and then they eat the termites off.
Yeah, it actually sounds like a very similar process. It's just they're fishing for two different kinds of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But interestingly, these on the blog, these scientists note that they just published a new study on termites, and this is January of this year, where they demonstrate that male Fongoli chimps appear to spend more time fishing for termites than chimps at any other site so far studied.
Hmm.
And in addition to that, these chimps also are the first group of chimps that have been seen using caves for shelter, and also bathing in water.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Right? So clearly these guys are up to something, and we really need the CIA or something to come watch them and make sure there isn't the Planet of the Apes thing coming along. Because,
like Scott Adams says, the monkeys are closing the gap.
I saw a very good documentary about this a little while ago, and it is chilling to watch these chimpanzees up in a tree with a big pointy stick stabbing into a little hole until they pull out what they look for. I don't think they had any actual footage of the chimpanzees killing a bush baby, but they had things like evidence of carcasses that had clearly been ripped apart and chewed on, and evidence of spears left in the holes and things like that. That's all went into the documentary. It's fascinating.
And tell me, have they discovered any large black monoliths in the area?
Not yet, but I believe that paper is in next week's science.
All right, that's all we've got for you in the news this week. Let's move on to our interview.
Hi there, this is Rebecca Watson of Skeptic and The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and you are listening to Consilience.
Joining us now is Dr. Adrian Tiplady, who works for the SKA in South Africa. Adrian, welcome to Consilience.
Thank you very much, sir.
And Adrian has just delivered a lecture at the Cybono Center, which we attended. It was very good, very informative, about the SKA, which is the Square Kilometer Array. And he has very kindly agreed to join us on an empty stomach to answer some extremely difficult and technical questions about astronomy. There's going to be math involved.
So, Adrian, maybe you can start off by just giving us a little bit of background about what you do with the SKA and how you got started with them.
I finished my PhD in 2004, and I was actually on my way to Paris to go and play jazz, and I got a phone call from my supervisor who said, well, he needed some help on this project called the SKA. So I found myself in Joburg at the beginning of 2005. In the final year leading up to our submission to the International SKA Project Office for Africa to host the SKA, which is going to be the biggest radio astronomy facility that has ever been built in history. And since then, well, I've done a bit of science. I build some things. I'm currently responsible for the site characterization, and what that means is looking at all the aspects that could potentially affect both the operation and scientific performance of the SKA, as well as construction costs, how much is it actually going to build, power designs.
Adrian, I wanted to ask you, what is your background? Obviously, you say you studied at Rhodes, but what did you study, and how did that lead you into the SKA?
Well, I went to Rhodes back in about 14 years ago, 1997. I went to Rhodes to study music. And the reason I went there is because I could study music and I could do something else at the same time.
What did you play?
I play saxophone and the piano. So I studied jazz and classical music, but I also did a degree in computer science, physics and electronics. And then I did an honors degree in telecommunications. And again, after that, I was like, oh, don't know. Don't really want to go get a real job, so let me stay at university some more. And it just so happened my supervisor was a radio astronomer, and radio astronomy was quite attractive because it required some theory, it required a bit of computational work, it required me building things, and I could continue playing music. So I just ended up staying at university doing my PhD in radio astronomy.
Okay, so perhaps the most basic question is, I know you've just explained this to a room full of people, but we've spoken about the SKA a little bit, but perhaps you can just give your professional explanation of what exactly is the SKA, what is its current status, and what are those damn Aussies up to?
Sheep farming? No, okay, so what is the SKA? Well, the SKA is a plan to build the biggest radio astronomy facility in history. It's going to be something like 50 to 100 times more powerful, more sensitive than anything that currently exists today. The technology, the computing technology around it is going to be something that we've never seen before. As an example, there's a prototype facility in the Netherlands called LOFAR. LOFAR is a couple percent of the SKA in terms of collecting area and operates at low frequencies. The supercomputer that was installed for LOFAR, I could be corrected if I'm wrong, but it was something of like the fourth most powerful supercomputer in the world at the time. Could have been the most powerful, but I think it was certainly in the top five. And that's in order to process all of the data coming from each and every single receiver. You want to build a very sensitive instrument which is broken up into lots of small receivers. You've got to collect all of that data coming in and process it and make it, into a manageable chunk for any scientist or astronomer. So what the SKA is something like approximately 3,000 dishes. Each of those dishes is about 15 meters in diameter, approximately. It will be a mixture of hybrid technologies of receivers. So it won't be just dishes. There will also be things called aperture arrays. And aperture arrays, you can imagine, are simply like almost like TV aerials stuck in the ground. Traditionally, you use a dish in order to point your beam at some. You want to point it at a source. You move your dish, and you point it at the source. Then scientists got clever and decided, well, what happens if we take the receiver out and just put it on the ground? We don't have the dish. What can we do then? Well, we can still add up all the signals together and create the dish in software. That's a huge bonus because it allows us to look at the entire sky all at once, and then in software, you know, program a survey to look in a certain part of the sky. We can use the data over and over and over again and do multiple surveys using the same amount of data. So, huge amounts of data. The SKA is going to revolutionize astronomy and astronomical science. So currently, Africa is shortlisted along with Australia and New Zealand to host the SKA project. We went through a bidding competition in 2005, and that's when we got shortlisted. So back in 2005, yes, Africa, so South Africa and eight African partner countries were shortlisted to host the SKA along with Australia and New Zealand. Since then, what we've been doing is we've been doing, you know, further analyses on our site, and these include things like things that will affect the scientific performance of the SKA, so the atmospheric quality of the site. Are there cyclones that go through your site every once in a while, which will blow away the dishes? Then other things like, how close is the closest power connection? How much is it going to cost to power the SKA at your site? And that's taken a number of years.
Can I ask, is it seismically stable in that area?
It is. Certainly no earthquakes happening in the Karoo. I understand. The only fault line, and forgive me, I'm not a geologist, but the continent of Africa, we've got obviously the Rift Valley, which is has a fault line, but there are no significant faults within South Africa. In fact, I believe that the town of Sutherland is one of the most seismically stable locations on the planet of the Earth. We are about 400 kilometres away, so I guess things are pretty stable there.
We've heard a lot in sort of the general media, and you also mentioned just now that the SKA is going to revolutionise astronomy and specifically radio astronomy. But can you give us sort of more information about what you're going to be using the telescopes to look at, what you're going to be using it to look for, you know, what, let's drill down a little bit, find out more about what the meat of it is.
Okay, so the whole of the SKA project was probably sold on about 5 different key science programs. There were a lot more, but it was decided we really need to prioritize because astronomers want everything. Give them a finger and they want your whole arm. So we had to really prioritize and look at where the key areas are that will address fundamental questions, the fundamental questions facing astronomers today. So one of them is, and I'm going to try and rattle these off the top of my head, the one is effectively search for dark matter and dark energy. This is something that, you know, has suddenly popped up. I don't know, as I mentioned earlier in my presentation, you know, some 10, 20 years ago, astronomers thought they really could understand the universe, how it operated. You know, everything was down to gravity. And suddenly we realized after a couple of simple experiments that normal matter and the things that we see today, the things that are affected by the laws of nature as we understand them, constitute something like 4% of the total energy of the universe. We've got this remaining stuff called dark matter. We can't see it. We don't know what it's made of. It's not made of normal stuff. We know it's there because we can see the effects of gravity from it on the stuff around it, but we just can't see it. That's why it's dark, I suppose. dark matter. And I guess to keep the theme going, that's why they call dark energy. And that's about 75% of the universe. So the SKA is really going to try and address those questions of what is actually dark matter and dark energy. The next one is looking at the evolution of the galaxies. There's this dark ages, so looking at the very first stars and galaxies beginning to form. There's another key science area that is looking at Einstein's theory of relativity. Was he right? Well, he's been right up until now, you know. I think
even when he thought he was wrong, he was actually right.
I do believe that the theory of relativity is, you know, one of the most tested theories in the history of science, and a theory is always a theory until it's proven wrong. So right now it's upheld everything.
He basically predicted dark energy, didn't he?
Yes.
Quintessence.
The cosmological constant, yes. So,
and then changed his mind and then had it proved.
Yeah.
Well, he had bad reasons, yeah, though.
He did.
But the point is, he was still right.
Yeah, right for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. What a guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was an interesting person, I suppose. I'm trying to think of the other key science area is looking at the effects of magnetic fields.
How do you measure magnetic fields with a radio wave? And how do you measure gravitational waves with a radio wave?
Well, there's this really great thing called Faraday rotation, which actually changes the polarization of the signal. So if you put a radio wave going through a magnetic field, it actually changes the polarization as it comes out. And so if you measure the Faraday rotation, you can actually from that determine the strength of the magnetic field. And you can create a map. If you have multiple samples across the sky, you actually create a map of the effects of Faraday rotation, and from that you can determine the structure of the magnetic field going throughout the universe. Of course, one of the most interesting areas of the SKA, and I suppose the one that is the most popular, is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's quite a bad term to refer to it. It's more, you know, the origins of life. Are there other planets out there which could potentially inhabit life? Astrobiology, it's a great thing.
So we're not going to ask you to elaborate on all of those, but for example, if in 2022 and the thing is running nicely, what would your dream observation be when it comes to, you know, with the exception of a little green man signal, what would your dream observation be when it comes to something like dark matter? What observation could we make with the SKA that we can't make with any other instrument that would give us a key insight? So,
well, it's quite interesting that you say little green signal, little green man signal, because as it so happens, my area and my PhD was on pulsars, and pulsars are these, I like to, these big diamonds in space which are spinning around like lighthouses, and when they were discovered back in 1967, I think. Well, so this is yet another controversy in historical astronomy, astronomy history, should I say. It was discovered by a woman by the name of Jocelyn Bell, and her supervisor got the Nobel Prize for the discovery. But when it was first discovered, there were two pulsars that were discovered, and they were given the annotation LMG1 and LMG2. No, LGM1 and LGM2. Which happened to stand for Little Green Man 1 and Little Green Man 2.
Because it was so regular, yeah, a pulse that they thought it could be nothing but...
Nature could produce such a regular,
yes,
and rapid pulse. Yeah.
And they were wrong.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, one of the really great experiments that the SKA could first do is using these lighthouses in space. They're clocks, basically. And the distribution of the clocks across the sky will enable us to detect gravitational waves moving through space. And it will help us and give us information on Einstein's theory of relativity. But the other one, which targets development of the dark matter and dark energy, is really how the very first stars and galaxies began to form. And the way we would do that is we would take the SKA, look at the universe, or look at the sky, in a spectrum, part of the spectrum below 1400 megahertz. At 1421 megahertz is the signal, is a hydrogen signal, atomic hydrogen signal. And that is the gas which fills the universe. And that is the very first gas that is formed following the Big Bang. So if we can trace that and trace the signal from that gas from the Big Bang all the way up until today, and as I like to describe it, create a PowerPoint presentation with a slide, and each slide is a snapshot of the universe throughout at a different age of the universe. That would be a phenomenal experiment. it will allow us to trace exactly how stars and galaxies, from the moment of creation until today, how they formed, how they evolved, how dark matter and dark energy interacted with the hydrogen gas and all the creation of the very first stars and galaxies, how all of that happened. That's probably dream number one. The pulsars experiment with the gravitational waves is probably dream number two. Dream number three is finding ET's home, I suppose.
During your presentation, you mentioned two other instruments, Cat7 and Meerkat. What are those instruments and how are they related to the SKA?
The SKA is almost future-proofed. It's designed to be constructed and built from the technology that is available at the time of construction. So when it was first spoken about, none of the computing technology existed, and much of it still doesn't exist. But what we decided to do is we decided to develop a technology path to the SKA. And in order to do that, we are creating SKA precursor instruments. The first of those is called Cat7. So that's a 7-dish array. It's the first radio interferometer for radio astronomy purposes that has been built in South Africa before. And that is an engineering prototype. We're trying out new types of disk construction, new types of data processing, developing new types of digital back-end instrumentation. The Meerkat telescope Cat7 is in fact is a prototype for the Meerkat telescope. The Meerkat telescope is again a precursor for the SKA. Slightly bigger than Cat7, it's 64 dishes. When it is commissioned, it will be one of the premier radio astronomy facilities in the world. It will use next generation back-end digital back-end and technologies. It will operate across an extremely wide frequency range, and it will really be able to do science that you can't really do anywhere else in the world. Currently the de facto standard or premier array of telescopes in the world is the VLA in New Mexico. Now, we're effectively building EVOA, is now the upgraded version of the VLA, the EVOA. So we are building the EVOA in South Africa, in the Southern Hemisphere.
VLA is a very large array, and the?
EVOA is the expanded.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It's expanded.
So that's an upgrade in the receivers. I cover a much wider range of the spectrum and things like that. It's a fantastic instrument. The problem is it's built in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, in the Northern Hemisphere, obviously, there's a proliferation of radio astronomy facilities, as you saw in the image I showed earlier this evening. Not such a great place, not very radio quiet, and you can't really see a large part of the galaxy. You build a telescope in the Southern Hemisphere, you can see most of the galaxy. You can see the center of our galaxy, which in fact passes directly over South Africa, straight overhead. We have the best shot on the surface of the planet to look at the Milky to look at the center of our galaxy, which is one of the most interesting parts, because there's a black hole in the middle of our galaxy. And if you want to look at things like the theory of relativity, you want to look at things that are circling around black holes. And that's what the Meerkat is going to be. It's going to be able to do stuff like that, but it's not just an engineering prototype, it's a science prototype. It's going to be starting to answer some of the questions that we're going to answer with the SKA. And we may very well answer them with Meerkat. Now, these are the fundamental questions that astronomers are trying to answer around the world. And something like the Meerkat may be able to start answering, if not answering them completely.
And Meerkat is fully funded by the South African government?
Yep, it's fully funded by the South African government. We've also got a major human capital development program associated with the Meerkat telescope. To date, I think in the last 3 or 4 years, we've sponsored at least 300 students from undergraduate straight through to postdoctoral fellowships. We've created new astronomy departments in some of the universities in South Africa. So, for example, the University of Western Cape is a new department of astronomy. We have existing engineering departments that have actually joined the radio astronomy program, such as the Department of Engineering at the University of Stellenbosch. We've hired new staff for other departments in South Africa which have existing astronomy departments. So there is a massive human capital development program associated with building the Meerkat.
We went on a tour of HARTRA last weekend with some of the Gauteng skeptics, and I have two questions for you. First of all, is that kind of thing going to be possible with the CAT telescopes and the Meerkat telescopes? Will you be able to open to the public and have people come in?
Well, okay, here's a. It's great that you can go and visit Hard Drive, but you notice when you drive into Hard Drive, there's a little sign which says, please turn off your cell phone. I guarantee you, half of the staff don't even turn off their cell phones. Right? So you want to build a radio astronomy observatory away from people. Because people are just bothersome and are a nuisance. So we go and build in the middle of the Karoo. Unfortunately, the Karoo is an absolutely extraordinary place to go and visit. You can go into the middle of the Karoo in the middle of the night, and you can see the Milky Way going straight down to the horizon. You would not believe how many stars you can see in the middle of the Karoo. You know, I've looked at pictures taken with optical telescopes, and you can see that many stars easily in the Karoo with your naked eye. So it's a beautiful place to go to. Great place to build a radio telescope because there's no one there. And the actual site and facility is really fun. You know, there's stuff to look at and engineering stuff. No, there are no lions in the Karoo. Those lions were in Botswana. There are meerkats, though. It's actually a funny story how Meerkat got its name. When we first got funded, we were going to build the CAT telescope, which stood for Karoo Array Telescope. And then the South African government decided they were really going to invest in astronomy and gave us more money so we could build a bigger telescope, which is called Meerkat. And for those of you listeners who don't know, Meer in Afrikaans means more, so we have more cat. So it's great, but what we'd rather do is we'd rather set up visitor centres in the nearby towns where you can go to the visitor centre, see a model of the Meerkat. Maybe look at a webcam which is erected at the site so you can look at the telescopes. Maybe you can even play with a model telescope there. And then you have lunch in a restaurant and you can have an auditorium, watch some movies or something like that. The local community gets a benefit out of it. It's our educational centre. And then you leave and go back home to drink. And you just stay away from our site.
My little boy, during this tour of Hartrell, he asked when he'll be able to see a black hole. Could you give him a proper scientific answer for when he can see a black hole?
Never.
That's what I said.
A black hole is black because light doesn't escape it, and you may have, but you can certainly see what is called the event horizon, which is that just at that point where light no longer orbits around the black hole but escapes, and that we can see. We can see the kinds of effects around the black hole. The problem about black holes is it's where science and fiction all roll up into one, and the laws of physics begin to break down near the black hole. Funny things start to happen. Time slows down. Physics goes funny there, and this is beyond the scope of any of my expertise whatsoever. But we certainly know, and we certainly believe, that at the center of every galaxy out there is a black hole, and there are millions, hundreds of millions of galaxies and hundreds of millions of stars within each galaxy. So we can look around a black hole, which seems to be good enough at this stage.
Gravitational lensing as well, like Stevens Quintet, where it's a group of galaxies behind a black hole and we can see them reflected around the black hole.
Yep, and you see the artifacts around, yeah. So you can certainly see the effects of black hole. You know that a black hole is there. You can almost identify when a black hole is created, assuming that if you see a supernova. The supernova could result in a number of different artifacts, but one of them, depending on the size of the initial sun, is a black hole. So you can certainly see the effects of the black hole, especially its gravitational effects, and that's the most interesting.
Adrian, I wanted to ask you about the environmental impact of the SKA, because you've got an area which is going to be protected, which I think is fantastic. It's in a very geologically stable area. We're not going to talk about fracking. We know you're going into the power grid of ESCOM. I feel very sorry for you when the power goes down. But I'm just wondering about the environmental impact, especially on those small towns which basically fall within your protected area, which are naturally going to experience some growth which may interfere with the operation of the SKA.
Okay. Yeah, we are protecting the area with what I believe is the most progressive legislation in the world of its type, to not only protect radio astronomy, but all forms of astronomy. The protected area which we are looking at is something of the order of 500,000 square kilometers, which is significantly larger than anywhere else in the world. In order to do that protection, in order to cover quite a wide area, obviously you're going to include communities which are living within that area. Now, I'll take the example of Sutherland. The town of Sutherland, living right next to an optical telescope, and through bylaws, they've been able to manage the light interference from the town by replacing light bulbs, street lights to only point downwards and things like that. Similarly, we can do the same thing in a protected astronomy reserve. We're not going to build a radio telescope in the middle of the town of Carnarvon. There's a town that already exists. We're not going to build it there. So the town of Carnarvon, it can obtain all the services that it would normally obtain. But we just need to be clever in how we do that. You don't need to put up a big transmitter broadcasting television out to a huge rural area with a population of a couple thousand people, when instead, for effectively the same cost, you can give everyone satellite TV, and the satellite signal is already there. It's there around the world. So I'm not particularly worried about allowing people to have satellite TV in the Karoo, because you can get it in Western Australia as well. So that's certainly not a problem. And we are obviously working with the community to try to develop better technical solutions to access to telecommunication services. So one is satellite, the other is a GSM, cell phone, access to cell phone services, and we're working on ways to try and optimize the environment, the radio frequency environment. There's no way we can get an ideal environment. The ideal environment is no radio signals there whatsoever, but that's not possible anywhere on the face of the planet. I understand that there are radio signals in the Netherlands which are picked up from Denmark, and that's because they reflect off planes.
So the SKA on the dark side of the moon.
Well,
that would be awesome.
Slightly more expensive.
It's actually called Lunar Lofar. Go look it up. It's great place to build it, but you've got to build a space shuttle in order to build the telescope. So we all of those people in the communities are involved in developing the protection requirements for the SKA.
Have they welcomed the development, the general communities in that area?
Yeah, obviously there's when the concept of an astronomy reserve is put up without providing a context and explaining how it will be established, there's some worry in the community that this means they won't be able to do anything. They won't be able to go drive to the farms, use arc welders. They will lose all their cell phone services, etc. And that's not the case. It's just a communicating it in a nice, easily understandable package is quite a difficult thing for us. But we involve the entire community in all of our public participation processes.
We've mentioned the Australians a couple of times, and that's because we're currently competing with them in the bid to host the SKA. What is your analysis of the comparison between our site and the Australian site, and who do you think is going to win?
Far be it for me to decide who's going to win. I think Africa, and South Africa in particular, provides an opportunity for the rest of the world. Scientifically, I believe the SKA site is, in South Africa, is one of the best sites in the world to build any type of radio astronomy facility. Along with Australia, the site in Western Australia is also extremely good. If South Africa wasn't participating within the SKA project, it would probably be built in Western Australia. So I believe we have a site which is easily comparable and has the same scientific qualities, significantly better than any other radio astronomy site in the world, and can fulfill all of the scientific requirements for the SKA. Technically, I believe the fact that we have existing infrastructure, so our site is remote, but it's not too remote. You know, as you mentioned earlier, the best place to build a radio telescope is on the dark side of the moon. The problem is you have to build a space shuttle to get there, right? And you've got to get all the data back, and you've got to get power there and things like that. So there's a trade-off. You can find the best site in the world, but if it's going to cost you 60% of your budget to build all the infrastructure to connect your site to the rest of the world, you're not going to have much left to build a big telescope. So our site is remote, but it's not too remote that we can actually connect it, build all the infrastructure. Our construction costs are very low. And I do not believe that there's a significant risk of us having a detrimental impact on the SKA in constructing it, and therefore the scientific performance of the SKA if you build it in Africa because of our low construction costs. And finally, I think if you look at the potential benefits of the SKA and the fact that investment in ICT infrastructure in Africa is an extremely important thing, and it will have a significant impact, socio-economic impact, on 9 African countries. I think scientifically, technically, and politically, Africa is a very, very good option for the SKA. And if Africa wasn't there, I think it would be built in Western Australia. But Africa is there. And we've got a darn good team of engineers, I can tell you that.
Adrian, thank you very much for your time. You've been very generous. It's late at night and we're in the middle of town, so we're going to jump in our cars and rush home. But yeah, please keep us posted.
I will be.
That was an excellent interview. Thank you again to Dr. Tiplady for joining us, and to Kathy Wagner for being our guest interviewer, joining our team for the evening. All right. Okay, let's have our quote for the week. This one comes from Terry Pratchett, and it is, "I will be more enthusiastic about encouraging thinking outside the box when there's evidence of any thinking going on inside it."
Oh, yeah.
Super.
Nice.
Good one.
And we think this was said by Terry Pratchett on a Usenet group in the 90s. I couldn't find the original source of it, but, you know, he said very similar things. And
it's clear that this represents his point of view.
Yeah, it represents his point of view, but, you know, never trust the internet when it comes to quotes.
Right. But still, if you've been living in a cave for the last 20 or 30 years, Terry Pratchett is a renowned fantasy author.
A humor fantasy author.
He wrote the Discworld series, which some people love and some people hate, but I love it. I think I own almost every single book in the whole series.
Well, some people love and some idiots hate.
Yeah.
I've never met someone who's like, yeah, that Terry Pratchett guy, I'm so. Either you enjoy it or you don't enjoy it.
Just reminds me of the Mitch Hedberg joke.
I played in a death metal band. People either loved us or they hated us, or they thought we were okay.
All right. Angela, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm at Angela Meaden on Twitter and the Skeptic Detective blog.
Excellent. And Mike, where can we find you on the internet?
On this podcast.
Nice.
My blog is Ionian Enchantment, which I will maybe perhaps conceivably update in the next while if I'm no longer so tired when I come back from work. And on Twitter, I am Michael Meaden, one word.
Nice. And you can find all of my stuff, including Google+, at owenswart.org.
But friend him on Facebook, because that's really where he likes to hang out.
I'm no longer accepting friend requests on Facebook. If you want to find me online, it's Google+ or nowhere.
Just wait till the Apple social network starts getting traction, and then that's where you'll find Owen.
No, no one will be on the Apple social network, because it'll be totally uncool to be where everyone is.
Yeah. Something tells me Apple won't let me have an account.
Yeah, something tells me. We're like, oh, no, not that guy again.
All right, well, that's all we have for you this week. Thanks to my co-hosts, our guests, and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to consiliencecast@gmail.com. The music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.